Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, Free Markets, the GDI series. This week, we meet Joseph Lehman, who heads one of America's most respected think tanks, the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, that does great work up in Michigan, and they know everybody up there. They even know Michael Moore, and they've worked with him on one or two things. And with Mr. Lehman, we will look into the window of the future, the window of opportunity. No, the Overton window. Because the Mackinac Center invented that theory, which is so useful now in the study of entrepreneurship. Here's Mr. Lehman. Joseph Lehman, many years ago, I interviewed the president of Dow Chemical, and I remember reading the research, and it said Midland, that she'd grown up in Midland, and that the company was in Midland, and I thought, man, I didn't know they were in Texas. What are they doing there? And then I suddenly realized, of course, reading a bit further, that there's a Midland, Michigan. And apart from Dow, another famous establishment in Midland, Michigan, is the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. What does it do?
That's right. We're the Mackinac Center, and we're a think tank. We study economic issues, mainly on the state of Michigan, but we cover labor policy, education policy, tax and budget matters, environmental matters, and on labor policy, we have more of a national footprint.
But you are very Michigan-oriented. If one reads the research, a lot of the examples concern programs in Michigan. That's obviously a choice. You did not want to be all things to all people. But why did you decide to be so strictly confined?
That was a strategic decision. Back in the 1980s, there was a visionary man named Tom Rowe who said, you know, what the country needs is several think tanks that work in the states. They would do similar kind of work to the think tanks in Washington, D.C., but a tremendous amount of policy is also made at the state levels in 50 state capitals around the United States. So that was his vision that sort of inspired groups like the Mackinac Center to establish themselves in the 50 states.
And it must, in a way, augment your clout because in Michigan, because you've concentrated your forces there, you can get the governor on the phone, I'll bet.
It's much easier to do that than it is to get the president on the phone. Yeah, that's right. We've had a good working relationship, better or worse, with various governors in Michigan over the years, with the leadership, with the leadership and the houses of the legislature. But what we tell our friends in Washington is that we can make change in real time in the states. And the way the United States is set up with 50 laboratories of democracy, this is really an excellent way to play that system out.
And so, for instance, corporate welfare, which is a big open question, which you oppose, you certainly picked the right state, so to speak, because of course it's there have been bailouts like Chrysler that were in the very, very high figures. You've had influence on that. You've been able to slow that down or prevent it.
Yeah, that's correct. I would say one of our biggest victories in ending unfair and unworkable corporate welfare has been the elimination of a film subsidy program where lawmakers got the bright idea that, well, let's turn Michigan into a haven for making movies. Now, Michigan has lots of advantages, but you couldn't really say that it has natural advantages for making movies, not too many of them. And so they were trying to use tax money to take it from businesses that have more natural advantages and put it toward these film companies. It cost $500 million before we
Holy
got it
cow.
Shut down. Yeah.
Didn't they shoot The Big Chill there? I'm just reaching back.
There was a movie, Gran Torino, that was actually a pretty good movie, and it was heavily subsidized. But, you know, if it's a good movie, people will buy a ticket. They don't need to pay it in their taxes, too.
No, that makes sense. Now, on the bailouts, the automobile bailouts, that's the big philosophical quandary. Some people say, come on, let's be realistic. Maybe it didn't make economic sense on paper, but it sure saved a lot of jobs and put food on the table for the people working there. And if you had taken apart the corporation or let it be sold off, you wouldn't be further ahead. That's the counter argument. What do you say?
Well, there's another way to look at it. These corporations, had they been allowed to survive or not based on their own resources, their assets wouldn't have just been No one would have just set fire to the assets. Mm-hmm. The assets would have been there, and they would have been available to be reorganized in a different form, maybe by more efficient automakers. But instead, what we have is, sadly, we've locked in now this idea that some companies are simply too big to fail. And we know that that leads them to take risks when they know the taxpayers will back them up. You know, smaller companies are not too big to fail.
Yeah, that's true.
And they have to be more prudent with their resources.
But what did you think when President, I think it was President Obama, it was under Obama, that that Chrysler or GM paid the money back?
Well, it sort of straddled the Bush and the Obama years.
Yeah.
We were critical of both. Paying some of the money back was a good idea, but still, take your average mom and pop business. They're not going to get bailed out even if they mm-hmm. have an opportunity to pay the money back. It's fundamentally unfair to force some taxpayers to pay for the business decisions of other taxpayers.
And I know you've listed a lot of the reasons why corporate welfare is bad. And I remember as I was reading that, I remembered a quote I'd read from an economist who was really discouraged and down on an analyst who was down on General Motors before the failure. And she had written, "This is not a car company, it's a health and insurance and pension company." That's what you want to fight against, is the entrenchment of all kinds of irrelevant but very costly measures.
Well, that's right. And you know, management and the unions at the automobile companies, they made decisions that they later came to regret, and that it burdened them with a lot of legacy costs. And what would have been the right thing to do would have been to let those decisions work their way out through the marketplace instead of forcing mm-hmm. everybody in the country to pay for other people's bad decisions.
And I know that this must have put you on a collision course with the unions, and reading your rules of corporate welfare and so on, I see that you also fought for right to work. And you succeeded, I think.
Yes,
Michigan.
That's correct. And so unions have played a very, very important part in the history of the United States, and particularly in Michigan, where union history is notable. Michigan is really the cradle of organized labor in
mm-hmm.
America
yeah.
and the stronghold of its power. And as we look at unions in their pure form, they're nothing more than people associating with one another to try to get a better deal for themselves. There's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
The problem comes in when compulsion is used to force people to support a union or to force businesses
yeah.
to negotiate. So you mentioned right to work, and we were advocating for a right to work law in Michigan for a couple decades. What right to work does is it simply says no worker can lose his or her job for refusing to support a union. It's not a very controversial
yeah.
Setup. And so in 2012, we were finally able to work with the legislature and the governor and free hundreds and hundreds of thousands of unionized workers from compulsion. And of course, many of them still choose to support the union.
I was going to ask you, how many take it up? How many take advantage of this?
Yeah, so what we found in public sector unions in particular, the largest teacher union, for example, around 25% of the teachers have said, yeah, I don't know that I want to support this union. And overall, I believe union membership in Michigan is down 37%.
And the dues are no longer due then when you
right.
when you opt out.
Right. And you know, and this is real money. A teacher would typically pay $1,000 a year in dues.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other unions are a little less. But you know, this is money that that parents can use for tutoring for the kids or for private school. They can use it to go on a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
They can, you know, the point is, this is the workers' money, and the union should not have the right to just skim it off the top for a union the worker may not want.
And to what extent, it reminds me a little bit of the debate on the minimum wage. The minimum wage, when you think of it, or rent control for that matter, in cities, when you think of programs like that, your initial human reaction is good, great. We want people to earn more. We don't want people being gouged by landlords. Okay, good. It's only later that the perverse effects become obvious, that in fact housing deteriorates and jobs are less because of those things. It takes a long time though for that to sink in. So how do you, I'm sure the unions must have countered you with all kinds of good sounding arguments. What was your counterattack?
Sure. So the unions mounted the argument that said that the workers who opt not to pay dues are free riders, mm-hmm. that they were still benefiting from the union. And it's true that they were because of a provision in U.S. law that says the unions have the privilege of monopoly representation of all the workers, whether they belong to the union or not. So the unions really like that provision, but they were using it as a way to argue against so-called free riders. And I remember a moment in a legislative testimony where a spokesman for the state's largest teacher union was before the Senate. And the questioner from the Senate asked the union spokesman, "Would you like to be relieved of the burden of representing those teachers who don't pay dues?" And there was a long pause, and the answer was no. So that, to me, was all the proof.
In other words, they want the monopoly. The power of negotiation is greater.
Right.
And all they lose, they do lose some dues, but the workers lose nothing.
Right. And the last thing that a union wants is workers who know they can get a better deal on their own outside mm-hmm. the union. So the unions still have locked down this what we call exclusive representation. But we're working on that as well through the courts and other means.
And we come now to something else that you've done that obviously has been, it's always said in marketing, if your product becomes a synonym for the generic version of every product, Kleenex, Xerox, that kind of thing, you've really hit the jackpot. You know, you're there forever. And so the Overton window, which is often mentioned in economic analysis and so on, is a creation, a conception of one of your colleagues at Mackinac. What is the Overton window?
The Overton window is a model of policy change, and it explains why some policies are possible to enact into law and others are not. So I can, here's an analogy. Lawmakers have all kinds of opinions on all kinds of policies, mm-hmm. but they can't vote into law any policy they want, just like they're ordering dessert from a menu. Mm-hmm. They can only vote into law those policies that the public will accept, or the lawmakers will find that the next time the election comes around, the voters will vote them out. Yeah. And so the Overton window just simply recognizes that when we want public policies, new public policies to become law, we don't start in the legislature. We start out in the world of think tanks and out in the culture where mm-hmm. we talk about these ideas and develop them and test them. And eventually opinion moves in the direction. And all the great social movements have been part of this. So take the idea of women's suffrage. It was about 105 years ago when women first got the vote in mm-hmm. the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, as crazy as it seems now, the right of women to vote seemed absurd because women could not vote anywhere. Mm-hmm. Well, now, years later, after being firmly put into policy, and we've seen that it hasn't wrecked the country and, you know, all of that.
Then it started to tumble in.
That's right. And so the Overton window concept began, it had humble origins as a fundraising brochure for our think tank, because we needed a way to show people how a think tank actually has influence over policy, even though we don't have a vote in the legislature. And our influence comes from being able to develop these ideas, which eventually become policy.
But it doesn't always work. I think I read in the research, you also give examples like prohibition, where the idea of temperance went through the same thing as female suffrage. At first it was laughed at, and then by God it became law. But it failed.
That's right. There is such a thing as overshooting the Overton window. And prohibition was exactly that. There were a lot of social forces making the arguments against alcohol, and there were a lot of harmful social effects from alcohol. None of that was wrong, but what was not properly anticipated was the solution would bring with it problems of its own.
Yeah.
And then that shifted the Overton window back.
Like speakeasies.
And organized crime.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And people are forced to recognize that. So how do you pick your issues? How do you open the window?
Good question. Well, think tanks are at their best when they're working just outside of today's Overton window. They're working on ideas that aren't quite politically possible yet.
Mm-hmm.
So in every think tank has its areas of expertise. I don't think a good think tank would try to be all things to all people. So we focus mainly on education policy,
mm-hmm.
labor policy, tax and budget and fiscal issues and some environmental issues and things, that really makes up more than 80% of our portfolio. And it's those issues where we have on-staff experts and can make a difference.
And I guess there are some cases where it really worked well and you can measure it. I'm thinking of tobacco. There's an example where at first it was really laughed at, the idea that people have to go freeze outside to smoke,
mm-hmm.
or that parks, you couldn't smoke in a park or in a restaurant, in a busy restaurant. But it happened.
People have become accustomed to it. And
it's an Overton window classic, sort of.
Yeah, it really did. People have become accustomed to it. There may be better tobacco policies out there. I have no doubt that some restaurants would voluntarily make themselves smoke-free and others would, have smoking areas. We've got a little bit of a one-size-fits-all policy
mm-hmm.
now in the United States, but most people do tend to prefer it.
Moderate smoking does not exist like moderate drinking. If it did, probably that would end up being the result. Moderate smoking, there's no such thing.
Yeah, you could be right.
And are there things that are, it seems to me there must be some that are uphill climbs, like Mothers Against Drunk Driving. That has worked. The window has opened, but I'm sure everybody was predicting failure.
That's a perfect example of what began as a social movement. And, decades ago, law enforcement would kind of look the other way if somebody got stopped drunk driving. And now the penalties are severe. There's very little tolerance for drunk driving.
And all came from that little organization.
It did. And I think we're probably better off because of it.
And are there some that are pure poison? In other words, I'm thinking, capital punishment, abortion. The big questions that hang over every election and so on. I would think no Overton man or woman wants to touch that. Am I right?
Well, there are some questions which are more, more binary, and they don't really go on a sliding scale. And abortion may be one of them. Capital punishment may be one of them. And I would say that the Overton window describes one big thing, but it's not a perfect way to get a handle on every
mm-hmm.
single issue.
But you can move the window. I was interested when I was reading the thing. You can really, if you start to think in those terms, then you can measure the disapproval or the approval and measure how it's moving along, get more funds, I guess, if it is opening, and work on that basis. I mean, it's a systematic way of changing public opinion.
Yeah, and it's a way of showing, it's simply using the powers of persuasion. I compare free speech to
mm-hmm.
to the Overton window or the scientific method. Today's science will be replaced by tomorrow's better science, but it's only because scientists are constantly challenging today's settled theories. And they'll be coming up with theories that have greater explanatory power, or they'll prove that today's are just wrong in some way. And then things will, then the accepted theories will shift.
And think tanks are becoming really almost a cutting edge for the media in general. The media used to comment on everything. They still do. We still do. But think tanks, when before they were part of the whole scene, the ideas would originate with editorial writers or columnists or whatever. With think tanks, it's more systematic. And I wonder if you don't generate a bit of your own opposition there, where people say, oh, no, not them again. You know, the minute you put your name on a study, they say, oh, no, not them. We know how they think. There must be some of that.
There is a little bit of that, but we have strong relationships with reporters, I mean, and newspapers, news outlets. They need content to get to their readers, and of course their business model is under a severe challenge right now.
Yeah.
But working with legacy media is still a very important part of getting our message out. But at the same time, it's never been easier for us to get our message out on our own through various social media and web platforms.
And the classic, at least the way I see it from the outside, it seems to me the classic modus operandi of think tanks is to generate statistics and studies, throw them out, and if they suit your purpose, throw them out there into the public debate. And then there's round two, where you have spokespeople, and maybe you get a celebrity endorser or a celebrity person to agree with you. How does it work? How do you do a campaign?
Yeah, the research and the statistics are absolutely at the core of what we do. But we've added quite a bit to that. So we realize that none of these, well, let me say it this way. The reason public policy matters is because public policy affects lives. And so we have gotten good at finding the people who are harmed by poor government policies and finding the people who would benefit from better ones and letting them tell their story. Because that gives our ideas a much greater appeal. People can see exactly how our ideas would apply, even if they don't know anything at all about economics. You shouldn't have to be an economist to know what public policy you prefer.
And the Heritage Foundation, for instance, is famous for persistence. And they don't care if you kick them in the shins and laugh at them and do anything. They will come back the next week with the same point under a different form, or the next month or the next year, and it works in many, many cases. Are you that? Is persistence an absolute necessity?
Yeah, that's right. Think tanks don't stand for election, so we don't have to trim our sails with which way the public, or the wind is blowing. And we are guided by a set of principles. And for the Mackinac Center and other free market think tanks, we don't hide the fact that we think that a free market approach is preferred. We take the free market approach to any public policy question. And think tanks rose to fill that niche because the universities weren't doing it very much and the media wasn't doing it very much, magazines and journalism, and so there needed to be an independent voice to advance a free market idea.
And is there, as success comes on a given campaign, does fundraising become more important or more successful?
Yeah, we go to people who, like us, have an affinity for free enterprise. And we ask them to support our work. And of course, success, breeds
more success.
But it's different from a political campaign. In fact, it's not similar at all. In a political campaign, people may donate money to their favorite candidate to try to get him elected or to win an election. But that's not what we do. We say, if you want free market ideas to have a voice, you should support the Mackinac Center.
And do you have, one of the things that people are rather worried about in America is the divide, the heartland versus the bi-coastal, or Republican versus Democrat, right versus left, all of that. And it's becoming pretty coherent and pretty obvious that there is such a divide. Does that force you to take sides?
It forces us to be strategic. So, for example, in Michigan right now, which is the state where we operate the Mackinac Center, the Republicans control all the levers of government. But nonetheless, we decided we're going to find our friends on the left. We tend to be more on the right on economic issues. We don't deal with social issues. We reached out to our friends on the left, and we said we think we have agreement on issues like corporate welfare, criminal justice reform, and even occupational licensure. because these were things that people of good faith on all sides could see that there were just real problem. We were throwing the book at too many people with mm-hmm. minor offenses. And not only does that cost taxpayers a lot of money, it destroys lives.
Mm-hmm.
And with corporate welfare, the left is famous for being against corporate welfare in their speeches, although they vote for a lot of it, but so do the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that we can't have a country that's so divided against itself that it can't stand. So we've made extra effort to reach out and find those issues where we can work with friends on the left.
So you haven't been pigeonholed, and they don't say, well, that's a Republican outfit.
Well, somebody will try to pigeonhole us from time to time. And when they do, I said, oh, well, how pigeonholed can we be? We're working with the ACLU.
Right. And maybe one day with Michael Moore.
We did work with him once.
Your fellow citizen in Michigan.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, long life to you and to Mackinac.
Thank you very much.